Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Star Tide Rising by David Brin, narrated by George Wilson. This book is copyrighted 1983 and 1993 by David Brin. This recording is copyrighted 2003 by Recorded Books. And now, Star Tide Rising.
Prologue. From the Journal of Gillian Baskin. Streaker is limping like a dog on three legs. We took a chancy jump through overdrive yesterday, a step ahead of the galactics who were chasing us. The one probability coil that had survived the Morgren battle groaned and complained, but finally delivered us here, to the shallow gravity well of a small population 2 dwarf star named Kethsemane. The library lists one habitable world in orbit, the planet Kithrop. When I say habitable, it's with charity. Tom, Hikahi, and I spent hours with the captain looking for alternatives. In the end, Krydike decided to bring us here. As a physician, I dread landing on a planet as insidiously dangerous as this one, but Kithrop is a water world, and our mostly dolphin crew needs water to be able to move about and repair the ship. Kithrop is rich in heavy metals and should have the raw materials we need. It also has the virtue of being seldom visited. The library says it's been fallow for a very long time. Maybe the Galactics won't think to look for us here. I said as much to Tom last night, as he and I held hands and watched the planet's disk grow larger in one of the lounge ports. It's a deceptively lovely blue globe, swathed in bands of white clouds. The night side was lit in patches by dimly glowing volcanoes and flickering lightning. I told Tom that I was sure no one would follow us here, pronouncing the prediction confidently, and fooling nobody. Tom smiled and said nothing, humoring my bout of wishful thinking. They'll look here, of course. There were only a few interspatial paths Streaker could have taken without using a transfer point. The only question is, can we get our repairs finished in time and get away from here before the Galactics come for us? Tom and I had a few hours to ourselves, our first in days. We went back to our cabin and made love. While he sleeps, I'm making this entry. I don't know when I'll have another chance. Captain Krydike just called. He wants both of us up on the bridge, I suppose so the Finns can see us and know their human patrons are nearby. Even a competent dolphin spacer like Krydike might feel the need from time to time. If only we humans had that psychological refuge. Time to put this down and awaken my tired fellow. But first, I want to jot down what Tom said to me last night while we watched Kithrop's stormy seas. He turned to me, smiled that funny way he does when he thinks of something ironic, and whistled a brief haiku in dolphin trinary. The stars shake with storms, the waters below roll thunder. Still, are we wet, love? I had to laugh. Sometimes I think Tom is half dolphin. Part 1. Buoyancy. All your better deeds shall be in water writ. Francis Beaumont and John Fletcher. Chapter 1. Toshio. Finns had been making wisecracks about human beings for thousands of years. They had always found men terribly funny. The fact that humanity had recently meddled with their genes and taught them engineering hadn't done much to change their attitude. Finns were still smart alecks. Toshio watched the small instrument panel of his sea sled, pretending to check the depth gauge. The sled thrummed along at a constant 10 meters below the surface. There were no adjustments to be made, yet he concentrated on the panel as Kipiru swam up alongside, doubtless to start another round of teasing.
"Little hands, whistle!"
The sleek, gray cetacean did a barrel roll to Toshio's right, then drew nearer to eye the boy casually.
"Whistle us a tune about ships and space and going home."
Kipiru's voice, echoing from a complex set of chambers under his skull, rumbled like the groaning of a bassoon. He could just as well have imitated an oboe or a tenor sax.
"Well, little hands, where is your song?"
Kipiru was making sure the rest of the party could hear. The other Finns swam quietly, but Toshio could tell they were listening. He was glad that Hikahi, the leader of the expedition, was far ahead scouting. It would be far worse if she were here and ordered Kipiru to leave him alone. Nothing Kipiru said could match the shame of being protected like a helpless child. Kipiru rolled lazily, belly up, next to the boy's sled, kicking slow fluke strokes to stay easily abreast of Toshio's machine. In the crystal-clear water of Kithrop, everything seemed strangely refracted. The coral-like peaks of the metal mounds shimmered as though mountains seen through the haze of a long valley. Drifting yellow tendrils of dangleweed hung from the surface. Kipiru's gray skin had a phosphorescent sheen, and the needle-sharp teeth in his long, narrow V-mouth shone with a teasing cruelty that had to be magnified, if not by the water, then by Toshio's own imagination. How could a Finn be so mean?
"Won't you sing for us, little hands? Sing us a song that will buy us all fish brew when we finally get off this so-called planet and find a friendly port. Whistle to make the dreamers dream of land."
Above the tiny whine of his air recycler, Toshio's ears buzzed with embarrassment. At any moment he was sure Kipiru would stop calling him Little Hands and start using the new nickname he had chosen, Great Dreamer. It was bad enough to be taunted for having made the mistake of whistling when accompanying an exploration crew of Finns. They had greeted his absent-minded melody with raspberries and chittering derision. But to be mockingly addressed by a title almost always reserved for great musicians or humpback whales, it was almost more than he could bear.
"I don't feel like singing right now, Kipiru. Why don't you go bother somebody else?"
Toshio felt a small sense of victory in managing to keep a quaver out of his voice. To Toshio's relief, Kipiru merely squeaked something high and fast in gutter trinary, almost primal delphin, that in itself was a form of insult. Then the dolphin arched and shot away to surface for air. The water on all sides was bright and blue. Shimmering Kithrupan fish flicked past with scaled backs that faceted the light like drifting frosted leaves. All around were the various colors and textures of metal. Morning sunshine penetrated the clear, steady sea to glimmer off the peculiar life forms of this strange and inevitably deadly world. Toshio had no eye for the beauty of Kithrop's waters. Hating the planet, the crippled ship that had brought him here, and the Finns who were his fellow castaways, he drifted into a poignantly satisfying rehearsal of the scathing retorts he should have said to Kipiru.
"If you're so good, Kipiru, why don't you whistle us up some vanadium?"
Or,
"I see no point in wasting a human song on a dolphin audience, Kipiru."
In his imagination, the remarks were satisfyingly effective. In the real world, Toshio knew, he could never say any such thing. First of all, cetacean vocalizings were legal tender in countless spaceports. And while it was the mournful ballads of the larger cousins, the whales, that brought the real prices, Kipiru's kin could buy intoxicants on a dozen worlds merely by exercising their lungs. Anyway, it would be a mistake to try to pull human rank on any of the crew of the Streaker. Old Hannes Suessi, one of the other six humans aboard, had warned him about that just after they had left Neptune, at the beginning of the voyage.
"Try it and see what happens," the mechanic had suggested. "They'll laugh so hard, and so will I, if I have the good luck to be there when you do. Likely as not, one of them will take a nip at you for good measure. If there's anything Finns don't respect, it's a human who never earned the right, putting on patron airs."
"But the protocols," Toshio had started to protest.
"Protocols, my left eye. Those rules were set up so humans and chimps and Finns will act in just the right way when galactics are around. If the Streak gets stopped by a Soro patrol or has to ask a Peelin librarian for data somewhere, then Dr. Metz or Mr. Orly or even you or I might have to pretend we're in charge, because none of those stuffed shirt ETs would give the time of day to a race as young as Finn's. But the rest of the time we take our orders from Captain Krydike. Hell, that'd be hard enough, taking brown from a Soro and pretending you like it, because the damned E.T. is nice enough to admit that humans, at least, are a bit above the level of fruit flies. Can you imagine how hard it would be if we actually had to run this ship? What if we had tried to make dolphins into a nice, well-behaved, slavey client race? Would you have liked that?" At the time, Toshio had shaken his head vigorously. The idea of treating Finns as clients usually were in the five galaxies was repulsive. His best friend, Aki, was a Finn. Yet there were moments like the present when Toshio wished there were compensations for being the only human boy on a starship crewed mostly by adult dolphins. A starship which wasn't going anywhere at the moment, Toshio reminded himself. The acute resentment of Kipiru's goading was replaced by the more persistent, hollow worry that he might never leave the water world of Kithrop and see home. "Slow your travel, boy sled rider. Exploring pod does gather hither. Hikahi comes. We wait here for her." Toshio looked up. Rukida, the elderly dolphin metallurgist, had come up alongside on the left. Toshio whistled a reply in trinary. "Hikahi comes. My sled is stopping." He eased the sled's throttle back. On his sonar screen, Toshio saw tiny echoes converging from far ahead. The scouts returning. He looked up and saw Hist and Kipiru playing at the surface. Rukida switched to Anglic. Though somewhat shrill and stuttered, it was still better than Toshio's trinary. Dolphins, after all, had been modified by generations of genetic engineering to take up human styles, not the other way around.
"You've found no traces of the needed substances, Toshio?" Rukida asked.
Toshio glanced at the molecular sieve.
"No, sir, nothing so far. This water is unbelievably pure, considering the metal content of the planet's crust. Hardly any heavy metal salts."
"And nothing on the long scan?"
"No resonance on the bands I've been checking, though the noise level is awfully high. I'm not sure I'd be able to pick out monopole saturated nickel, let alone the other stuff we're looking for. It's like trying to find that needle in a haystack."
It was a paradox. The planet had metals in superabundance. One reason Captain Krydike chose this world as a refuge. Yet the water was relatively pure, enough to allow dolphins to swim freely, though some complained of itching, and each would need chelating treatments back on the ship. The explanation lay all around them, in the plants and fishes. Calcium did not make up the bones of Kithrupan life forms. Other metals did. The water was strained and sieved clean by biological filters. As a result, the sea shone all around with the bright colors of metal and oxides of metal. the gleaming dorsal spines of living fish, the silvery seed pods of underwater plants, all contrasted with the mundane green of chlorophyllic leaves and fronds. Dominating the scenery were metal mounds, giant spongy islands shaped by millions of generations of coral-like creatures, whose metallo-organic exoskeletons accumulated into huge, flat-top mountains rising a few meters above the mean watermark. Atop the islands, drill trees grew, sending metal-tipped roots through each mound to harvest organics and silicates, depositing a non-metallic layer on top and creating a cavity underneath. It was a strange pattern. Streaker's onboard library had offered no explanation. Toshio's instruments detected clumps of pure tin, mounds of chromium fish eggs, coral colonies built from a variety of bronze, but so far no convenient, easily gathered piles of vanadium, no lumps of the special variety of nickel they sought. What they needed was a miracle, one enabling a crew of dolphins with 7 humans and a chimpanzee to repair their ship and get the hell out of this part of the galaxy before their pursuers caught up with them. At best, they had a few weeks to get away. The alternative was capture by any of a dozen not entirely rational ET races. At worst, it could mean interstellar war on a scale not seen in a million years. It all made Toshio feel small, helpless, and very young. Toshio could hear, faintly, the high-pitched sonar echoes of the returning scouts. Each distant squeak had its tiny, colored counterpoint on his scanner screen. Then 2 gray forms appeared from the east, diving at last into the gathering above, cavorting, playfully leaping and biting. Finally, one of the dolphins arched and dove straight down toward Toshio.
"Hikahi's coming, and wants the sled topside," Kipiru chattered quickly, slurring the words almost into indecipherability. "Try not to get lost on the way up."
Toshio grimaced as he vented ballast. Kipiru didn't have to make his contempt so obvious. Even speaking Anglic normally, Finns usually sounded as if they were giving the listener a long series of raspberries. The sled rose in a cloud of tiny bubbles. When he reached the surface, water drained along the sides in long, gurgling rivulets. Toshio locked the throttle and rolled over to undo his faceplate. Sudden silence was a relief. The whine of the sled, the pings of the sonar, and squeaks of the fins all vanished. A fresh breeze swept past his damp, straight black hair and cooled the hot feelings in his ears. It carried scents of an alien planet, the pungence of secondary growth on an older island, the heavy, oily odor of a drill tree in its peak of activity. And overlying everything was the slight tang of metal. It shouldn't harm them, they'd said back at the ship, least of all Toshio in his waterproof suit. Chelating would remove all the heavy elements one might reasonably expect to absorb on a scouting trip, though no one knew for sure what other hazards this world might offer. But if they were forced to stay for months? Years? In that case, the medical facilities of the Streaker could not deal with the slow accumulation of metals. In time, they would start to pray for the Jofer or Thenanin or Soro ships to come and take them away for interrogation or worse, simply to get off a beautiful planet that was slowly killing them. It wasn't a pleasant thought to dwell on. Toshio was glad when Brukita drifted alongside.
"Why did Hikahi have me come up to the surface?"
he asked the elderly dolphin.
"I thought I was to stay out of sight below in case there were already spy sats overhead."
Brukita sighed. "I suppose she thinks you need a break. Besides, who could spot as small a machine as the sled with so much metal around?"
Toshio shrugged.
Well, it was nice of her.
Brukida rose up in the water, balancing on a series of churning tail strokes.
I hear Hikahi, he announced. And here she is.
Two dolphins came in fast from the north, one light gray in appearance, the other dark and mottled. Through his headphones, Toshio heard the voice of the party leader.
Flame-fluked eye, Hikahi call you, dorsal listening, ventral doing. Laugh at my words, but first obey them. Gather at the sled and listen.
Hikahi and Satata circled the rest of the party once, then came to rest in front of the assembled expedition. Among mankind's gifts to the Neo-Dolphin had been an expanded repertoire of facial expression. A mere 500 years of genetic engineering could not do for the porpoise what 1,000,000 years of evolution had for man. Fins still expressed most of their feelings in sound and motion, but they were no longer frozen in what humans had taken, in some degree of truth, to be a grin of perpetual amusement. Fins were capable now of looking worried. Toshio might have chosen Hikahi's present expression as a classic example of delphin chagrin.
Fippet has disappeared, Hikahi announced. I heard him cry out over to the south of me, then nothing. He was searching for Sasia, who disappeared earlier in the same direction. We will forego mapping and metals search to go and find them. All will be issued weapons.
There was a general susurration of discontent. It meant the Finns would have to put on the harnesses they had only just had the pleasure of removing on leaving the ship. Still, even Kipiru recognized this was urgent business. Toshio was briefly busy dropping harnesses into the water. They were supposed to spread naturally into a shape suitable for a dolphin to slip into, but inevitably one or two fins needed help fitting the small nerve amplifier socket each had just above the left eye. Toshio finished quickly, with the unconscious ease of long practice. He was worried about Sasia, a gentle fin who had always been kind and soft-spoken to him.
Hikahi,
he said, as the leader swam past. Do you want me to call the ship? The small gray tersiops female rose up to face Toshio.
Negative, ladder runner. We obey orders. Spy sats may be high already. Set your speed sled to return on auto if we fail to survive what is in the southeast.
But no one's seen any big animals.
That is only one possibility. I want word to get back whatever our doom, should even rescue fever strike us all.
Toshio felt cold at the mention of rescue fever. He had heard of it, of course. It was something he had no desire to witness. They set forth in skirmish formation. The Finns took turns gliding along the surface, then diving to swim alongside Toshio. The ocean bottom was like an endless series of snake tracks, pitted by strange pockholes like deep craters, darkly ominous. In the valleys, Toshio could usually see bottom, 100 meters or so below, gloomy with dark blue tendrils. The long ridges were topped at intervals by the shining metal mounds, like hulking castles of shimmering spongy armor. Many were covered with thick, ivy-like growths, in which Kithrupan fishes nested and bred. One metal mound appeared to be teetering on the edge of a precipice, the cavern dug by its own tall drill tree, ready to swallow the entire fortress when the undermining was done. The sled's engine hummed hypnotically. Keeping track of his instruments was too simple a task to keep Toshio's mind busy. Without really wishing to, he found himself thinking, remembering. A simple adventure, that's what it had seemed when they had asked him to come along on the space voyage. He had already taken the jumper's oath,
so they knew he was ready to leave his past behind, and they needed a midshipman to help with hand-eye work on the new Dolphin ship. Streaker was a small exploratory vessel of unique design. There weren't many finned, oxygen-breathing races flying ships in interstellar space. Those few used artificial gravity for convenience, and leased members of some client species to act as crafters and handmen. But the first Dolphin-crewed starship had to be different. It was designed around a principle which had guided Earthlings for two centuries. Whenever possible, keep it simple. Avoid using the science of the galactics when you don't understand it. 250 years after contact with galactic civilization, mankind was still struggling to catch up. Species which had been using the eons-old library since before mammals appeared on Earth, adding to that universal compendium with glacial slowness, had seemed almost godlike to primitive Earthmen in their early lumbering slow ships. Earth had a branch library now, supposedly giving her access to all wisdom accumulated over galactic history, but only in recent years had it proven more help than a confusing hindrance. Streaker, with its complex arrangements of centrifugally held pools and weightless workshops, must have seemed incredibly archaic to the aliens who looked it over just before launch. Still, to Earth's Neo-Dolphin communities, she was an object of pride. After her shakedown cruise, Streaker stopped at the small human-dolphin colony of Calathea to pick up the best graduates of its tiny academy. It was to be Toshio's first and possibly last visit to Old Earth. Old Earth was still home to 90% of humanity, not to mention the other terrestrial sapient races. Galactic tourists still thronged in to gawk at the home of the enfant terrible, who had caused such a stir in a few brief centuries. They were open in their wagering over how long mankind would survive without the protection of a patron. All species had patrons, of course. Nobody reached spacefaring intelligence without intervention by another, older race. Had not men done this for chimps and dolphins? All the way back to the time of the mythical progenitors, every species that spoke and flew spaceships had been raised up by a predecessor. None still survived from that distant era, but the civilization the progenitors established, with its all-encompassing library, went on. Toshio wondered, as just about everyone had for three centuries, what the patrons of man might have been like, if they ever existed. Might they even be one of the species of fanatics that had ambushed the unsuspecting Streaker, and even now sought her out like hounds after a fox? It wasn't a pleasant line of thought, considering what the Streaker had discovered. The Terrigan's Council had sent her to join a scattered fleet of exploration vessels, checking the veracity of the library. So far, only a few minor gaps had been found in its thoroughness. Here a star misplaced, there a species miscatalogued. It was like finding someone had written a list describing every grain of sand on a beach. You could never check the complete list in 1,000 lifetimes of a race, but you could take a random sampling. Streaker had been poking through a small gravitational tide pool, 50,000 parsecs off the galactic plane, when she found the fleet. Toshio sighed at the unfairness of it. 150 dolphins, 7 humans, and a chimpanzee. How could we have known what we found? Why did we have to find it? 50,000 ships, each the size of a moon. That's what they found. The dolphins had been thrilled by their discovery, the biggest derelict fleet ever encountered, apparently incredibly ancient. Captain Krydike had psi-cast to Earth for instructions. Damn it! Why did he call Earth,
Couldn't the report have waited until we'd gone home? Why let the whole eavesdropping galaxy know you'd found a sargasso of ancient hulks in the middle of nowhere? The Terrigan's council had answered in code. Go into hiding. Await orders. Do not reply. Krydike obeyed, of course, but not before half the patron lines in the galaxy had sent out their warships to find Streaker. Toshio blinked. Something. A resonance echo at last? Yes, the magnetic ore detector showed a faint echo toward the south. He concentrated on the receiver, relieved at last to have something to do. Self-pity was becoming a bore. Yes, it would have to be a pretty fair deposit. Should he tell Hikahi? Naturally, the search for the missing Krufen came first, but a shadow fell across him. The party was skirting the edge of a massive metal mound. The copper-colored mass was covered with thick tendrils of some green hanging growth.
Don't get too close, little hands,
Kipiru whistled from Toshio's left. Only Kipiru and the sled were this close to the mound. The other fins were giving it a wide berth.
We know nothing of this flora, Kipiru continued. And it's near here that Phippet was lost. You should stay safe within our convoy.
Kipiru rolled lazily past Toshio, keeping up with languid fluke strokes. The neatly folded arms of his harness gleamed a coppery reflection from the metal mound.
Then it's all the more important to get samples, isn't it?
Toshio replied in irritation.
That's what we're here for.
Without giving Kipiru time to react, Toshio banked the sled toward the shadowy mass of the mound, entering darkness as the island blocked the afternoon sunlight. A drifting school of silver-backed fish seemed to explode away from him as he drove at an angle along the thick fibrous weed. Kipiru squeaked in startlement behind him, an oath in primal Delphin, which showed the fin's distress. Toshio smiled. The sled hummed cooperatively as the mound loomed like a mountain on his right. Toshio banked and grabbed at the nearest flash of green. There was a satisfying snapping sensation as his sample came free in his hand. No fin could do that. He flexed his fingers appreciatively, then twisted about to stuff the clump into a collection sack. Toshio looked up and saw that the green mass, instead of receding, was closer than ever. Kipiru's squalling was louder. Crybaby, Toshio thought. So I let the controls drift for a second. So what? I'll be back in your damned convoy before you finish making up a cuss poem. He steepened his leftward bank and simultaneously set his bow planes to rise, then realized it was a tactical mistake. For it slowed him down just enough for a cluster of pursuing tendrils to arrive. There must be larger sea creatures on Kithrip than the party had seen so far, for the tentacles that fell about Toshio were obviously meant to catch big prey.
Oh, coino ante, now I've done it!
He pushed the throttle over to maximum and braced for the expected surge of power. Power came, but not acceleration. The sled groaned, stretching the ropey strands, but forward movement was lost. Then the engine died. Toshio felt a slithery presence across his legs, then another. The tendrils began to tighten and pull. Gasping, he managed to twist onto his back and groped for the knife, sheathed at his thigh. The tendrils were sinuous and knotty, clinging to whatever they touched, and when one brushed the back of Toshio's exposed left hand, the boy cried out from searing pain. The fins squealed to each other, and there were sounds of vigorous movement not far away, but other than a brief prayer that nobody else was caught, Toshio had no time to think of anything but the fight at hand. The knife came free, gleaming like hope, and hope brought hope as two small strands parted under his slashing attack. Another, larger one, took several seconds to saw through. It was replaced almost instantly by two more. Then he saw where he was being drawn. A deep gash split the metal mound. Inside, a writhing mass of filaments waited. Deep within, a dozen meters farther up, something sleek and gray lay enmeshed in a forest of deceptively languid foliage. Toshio felt open-mouthed steam fill his face mask. The reflection of his own eyes, dilated and stricken, was superimposed on the motionless figure of Sassia. Gentle as her life had been, though not her death, the tide rocked her. With a cry, Toshio resumed hacking. He wanted to call out to Hikaki to let the party leader know of Sassia's fate, but all that came out was a roar of loathing of the Kithrupan creeper. Leaves and fronds flew through the churning water as he sliced out his hatred, to little good as the tendrils fell more numerous about him to draw him toward the gash. Ladder climber, sharp-eyed rhymer, call a fix for seeking finders, trill sonar through the leaf blinders. Hikaki calling. Above the churning of his struggle and the hoarseness of his breath, Toshio could hear combat sounds of dolphin teamwork. Quick trills of trinary, unslowed for human ears, except that one brief command and the whining of their harnesses.
Here! Here I am!
He slashed at a vine that threatened his air hose, barely missing the hose itself. He licked his lips and tried to whistle in trinary.
Holding off, the sea squid's beak, suckers tight and outlook bleak, havoc done, on Sassia wreaked.
Lousy form and rhythm, but the Finns would hear it better than a shout in Anglic. After just 40 generations of sapience, they still thought better in an emergency when using whistle rhyme. Toshio could hear the sounds of combat coming closer. But as if hurried by the threat, the tentacles began drawing him back more rapidly toward the gash. Suddenly a sucker-covered strand wrapped itself around his right arm. Before he could shift his grip, one of the burning knots reached his hand. He screamed and tore the tendril away, but the knife was lost to darkness. Other filaments were falling all about him. At that moment, Toshio became distantly aware that someone was talking to him, slowly and in Anglic.
"Says there are ships out there. Vice Captain Takata Jim wants to know why Hikaki hasn't sent a monopulse confirmation."
It was Aki's voice, calling from the ship. Toshio couldn't answer his friend. The switch for the sled radio was out of reach, and he was preoccupied.
"Don't respond to this message," Aki went on obligingly.
Toshio moaned at the irony as he tried to pry a tendril off his face mask without doing further insult to his hands.
"Just transmit a monopulse and come on back, all of you. We think there's a space battle going on over Kithrup. Probably those crazy ETs followed us here and are fighting over the right to capture us, just like at Morgren."
"Gotta close up now. Radio silence. Get back as soon as you can. Aki out."
Toshio felt a tendril seize hold of his air hose, a solid grip this time.
"Sure, Aki, old friend," he grunted as he pulled at it. "I'll be going home just as soon as the universe lets me."
The air hose crimped shut, and there was nothing he could do. Fog filled his face mask. As he felt himself blacking out, Toshio thought he saw the rescue party arrive, but he couldn't be sure if it was real or a hallucination. He wouldn't have expected Kipiru to lead the charge, for instance, or for that Finn to have such a ferocious demeanor, heedless of the burning suckers. In the end, he decided it was a dream. The laser flashes were too bright, the Sazer tones too clear, and the party came toward him with pennants waving in their wake like the cavalry that 5 centuries of Anglic-speaking man had come to associate with the image of rescue.
Chapter 6. Chapter 2 Galactics. On a ship in the center of a fleet of ships, a phase of denial was passing. Giant cruisers spilled out of a rent in space to fall toward the pinpoint brilliance of a nondescript reddish sun. One by one they tumbled from the luminous tear. With them came diffracted starlight from their point of departure, hundreds of parsecs away. There were rules that should have prevented it. The tunnel was an unnatural way to pass from place to place. It took a strong will to deny nature and call into being such an opening in space. The Apesiarch, in its outraged rejection of what is, had created the passage for its Tandu masters. The opening was held by the adamant power of its ego, by its refusal to concede anything at all to reality. When the last ship was through, the Apesiarch was purposely distracted, and the whole collapsed with soundless violence. In moments, only instruments could tell that it had ever been. The affront to physics was erased. The Apesiarch had brought the Tandu Armada to the target star well ahead of the other fleets, those who would challenge the Tandu for the right to capture the Earthship. The Tandu sent impulses of praise to the Apesiarch's pleasure centers. It howled and waved its great furry head in gratitude. To the Tandu, an obscure and dangerous form of travel had once again proved worth the risks. It was good to arrive on the battlefield before the enemy. The added moments would give them a tactical edge. The Apesiarch only wanted things to deny. Its task now finished, it was returned to its chamber of delusions, to alter an endless chain of surrogate realities until its outrage was needed by the masters once again. Its shaggy, amorphous shape rolled free of the sensory web, and it shambled off, escorted by wary guardians. When the way was clear, the Acceptor entered and climbed on spindly legs to its place within the web. For a long moment, it appraised reality, embracing it. The Acceptor probed and touched and caressed this new region of space with its far-flung senses. It gave out a crooning cry of pleasure. "Such leakage," the Acceptor joyously announced. "I had heard the hunted were sloppy sophants, but they leak even as they scan for danger. They have hidden on the second planet. Only slowly do the edges of their psychic shields congeal to hide from me their exact location. Who were their masters to teach these dolphins so well to be prey? Their masters are the humans, themselves unfinished," the leading stalker of the Tandu replied. Its voice was a rhythmic pattern of rapid clicks and pops from the ratchet joints of its mantis legs. "The Earthlings are tainted by wrong belief and by the shame of their own abandonment. The noise of 3 centuries shall be quieted when they are eaten. Then our hunter's joy will be as yours is when you witness a new place or thing." "Such a joy," the Acceptor agreed. "Now stir to get details," the stalker commanded. "Soon we do battle with heretics. I must tell your fellow clients their tasks." The Acceptor turned in the web as the stalker left and opened its feelings to this new patch of reality. Everything was good. It passed on reports of what it saw, and the masters moved the ships in response, but with the larger part of its mind, it appreciated, it accepted, the tiny red sun, each of its small planets, the delicious expectancy of a place soon to become a battlefield. Soon it felt the other war fleets enter the system, each in its own peculiar way. Each took a slightly inferior position, forced by the early arrival of the Tandu. The Acceptor sensed the lusts of warrior clients and the cool calculations of calmer elders.
It caressed the slickness of mine shields rigidly held against it, and wondered what went on within them. It appreciated the openness of other combatants, who disdainfully cast their thoughts outward, daring the listener to gather in their broadcast contempt. It swept up savage contemplations of the acceptor's own annihilation, as the great fleets plunged toward each other and bright explosions began to flash. The acceptor took it all in joyfully. How could anyone feel otherwise, when the universe held such wonders?
This ends Side 1 of Cassette 1.